Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
The space for winning comes from recognizing that you have this weird duality in your brain that, like, you didn't decide that. You didn't choose to have that idea about how men's or women's sexuality works. It was taught to you from the day people decided you were a boy or a girl. They started teaching you myths about how women's sexuality works and how men's sexuality works. So if couples focus not on desire, but on what kind of sex is worth having, that's Peggy's question to her clients, what kind of sex is worth having, then you will begin to want sex and anticipate it with pleasure because you know you're going to have a good time. That stereotype that women are, like, not interested in sex or cold and frigid, whatever, and men have very powerful sex drives that, like, they have to have sex or they'll die, that is the opposite of how it used to be in the English-speaking world until about between 1700 and 1800, the transition happened into that. But before that, it was exactly the opposite, that women's sexuality was rampant and out of control, and women's sexuality had to be leashed in order to prevent women from just having all the sex all the time. So the fact that it changed has nothing to do with, you know, our bodies change. It has to do with the cultural narrative changing.
Well, hello and welcome. This is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Thanks so much for spending your time here today. The voice you just heard was Emily Nagoski, and, well, I'm just going to read you her little mini bio from her website. Emily Nagoski is the award-winning author of the New York Times bestseller, Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. She also has a relatively recent book called Burnout that she references in our interview. It's called Burnout, The Secrets of Unlocking the Stress Cycle. She co-authors that with her twin sister, Amelia, and it's for women who feel overwhelmed and exhausted by all they have to do, yet worrying that they're not doing enough. I haven't read that book yet. However, I do have it on good authority from a listener who has read it and says it is very, very good. Spoiler alert. How do we simulate running from a lion in our current culture? Dancing in our kitchen to Beyonce. Ha! I can tell this is going to be a great book already. All right, back to her bio. Emily is a gifted and engaged speaker, which you will very shortly learn if you haven't heard that already. Emily is an expert in women's sexual well-being, healthy relationships, and the prevention of sexual violence and harassment. People bring Emily because Emily brings the science. And I would add to that, and does a really great job of being able to explain it and put it in context to have it matter to our lives. She also has some really great TED Talks as well, and I am going to link all of this stuff on the notes of the podcast on the website, so please definitely check it out. You got a delightful taste from the multiple intro quotes that I put out there because I had a really hard time deciding what to highlight because there's just so much good stuff in here. And if all that you've heard so far doesn't pull you in, well, here is an interesting thing that she talked about as well. Emily shares what couples who have maintained a really good sexual relationship over decades, what are the things they're doing? What simple things do they have in common? The answers might surprise you, or maybe they won't. They make a lot of sense, but it's something that I personally don't feel like in our culture we are encouraged to do. Before we dive into our conversation, I want to say thank you so much for supporting the podcast by listening, by sharing the podcast with people who you think might be interested. For those of you who are part of my Patreon community, thank you so very much. If you are interested in supporting the podcast and the work that I'm doing in a financial way, please feel free to do that. Go to wellnessrenpodcast.com, and on the left side, right above where you can sign up for weekly emails when we put out a new podcast episode, you can click on the Become a Patron button. That is a quick, easy, and safe way to sign up to support the podcast for as little as a dollar a month. You can be a part of supporting this work that I do and keeping these episodes coming with these amazing guests. Your support in whatever form that is and getting the message out about the podcast also shares their work and message and brings it to new people. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And in a kind of fun coincidence. If you happened to be at or listen to the Listen Local Wellness Renaissance podcast party episode, we talked about the new podcast that Patricia Engelking, the sexual authenticity coach, and I are doing together called Sex Matters. You can find, at the moment I record this, 3 episodes online at sexmatterspodcast.com. We are awaiting the approval for iTunes, so hopefully by the time this actually airs or is produced online, that will be available on iTunes too. So check it out. We have an update since I recorded the original intro. We did get approval from iTunes, so it is up and happening. If you are an iTunes user, go to Sex Matters. Sex Matters is written in red with a black background with little gray waves beneath it. Subscribe if you would, and after you've listened to a few, take a moment to give us a rating and a review if you would. Always welcome, but definitely helpful in the launching period. Thank you. Check it out. Again, that's sexmatterspodcast.com. And one last thing before we dive in, a wonderful word and invitation from our sponsor, a local author from here in Duluth.
Are you wishing you had more sacred guidance in your life or a certain clarity around difficult situations you're finding yourself in? Which way to go? What path is the highest one for you to take? I want to invite you to consider the idea that a spirit animal might be really useful to you and really helpful for you. My name is Sarah Seidelman, and I'm a physician and a shamanic healer, and I have found connecting with a spirit animal one of the most powerful, joyful experiences of my life, and I continue to visit almost daily with my spirit animal, Alice, who is an elephant. And I want to invite you to have an opportunity to connect with your spirit animal, because I think if we all connect with our spirit animals, the world will be a much more beautiful, joyful, and passion-filled place. And if you're curious to do so, please go to my website, followyourfeelgood.com. And there you can enter your name and email in the box, and you will get immediate access to a guided shamanic journey where I help introduce you to your, what I like to call your core beastie, or the spirit animal that's here to guide you and help you. Thanks for listening. And the website again is followyourfeelgood.com.
All right. I am so excited to share this with you guys. Let's dive in. I am so excited to have you here, Emily. This is just, it is a really true honor that you said yes, because I'm just really excited. This is such a huge topic. Sex is such a huge topic. And what you are bringing to the world, I think, is just so incredibly important. And everybody needs to read your book of any age and whatever.
Oh, thank you.
Gender. Yeah, no, it's great. I just love it. And I will put a bunch of information in the notes, because I want people to be aware of your TED Talks and the books that you have out are fantastic as well. So let's dive in. And I want to say to people too, you are very much based in science, but you have this amazing writing voice that brings it out and makes it so incredibly user-friendly. And it's just such a pleasure to read your work, whether it's in print or your audiobook. Thank you also. I'm glad they let you read your own audiobook on Audible.
It was the only thing I asked for in my book contract.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, good for you, because you do a fantastic job. And I think it's such a great way to hear your voice explaining everything. So I think it's great.
Thank you.
Yes. There are a billion things we could cover. So let's start here, because I think one of the things that you're really helping dispel are so many of the myths and the cultural kind of ideas that we have about sex and sexuality. And one of those things that comes up for me as a big umbrella is the fact that, you know, we have this kind of cultural concept that men and women just don't mesh sexually, that men's, you know, sex drive, quote unquote, is you know, so big, and women's is not. And I mean, people are starting to understand that that's a pile of crap, but I think there's a lot of work that really needs to be done, because I think the details are so important. So take that thought and run with it if you like.
Yeah, for me, the starting point for talking about it is making sure everybody knows that stereotype that women are like not interested in sex or cold and frigid, whatever, and men have very powerful sex drives that like they have to have sex or they'll die. That is the opposite of how it used to be in the English-speaking world until about between 1700 and 1800, the transition happened into that. But before that, it was exactly the opposite, that women's sexuality was rampant and out of control, and women's sexuality had to be leashed in order to prevent women from just having all the sex all the time. So the fact that it changed has nothing to do with, you know, our bodies change. It has to do with the cultural narrative changing, more women's voices being heard. And one of the things that women's voices were saying in the 18th century was, it's not that we want all this sex, it's that you are sexually assaulting us.
Ah.
Yeah. So as more women's voices became prominent, men started talking about what women were saying and turning that into women are not interested in sex, and like well-educated middle and upper class women have zero interest in sex. They are not bothered by sexual impulses. And it flipped on its head that well-bred women don't have any desire for sex. And women sort of divided into two types. There were the women you married, and there were the sluts that you just had sex with, prostitutes, sex workers.
Still have those today.
Right? Yeah. But now we're expected to be both at the same time.
Yes. I have had men say, well, if I go out with her and she sleeps with somebody, or she sleeps with me the first night, then she's, you know, clearly not the marrying kind, and I don't want to marry her. But if she doesn't sleep with me on the first night, then I don't want to go out with her.
Because she's not going to have sex with me.
Right.
Exactly.
How does one win? There is no space for winning in that.
Yeah. The space for winning comes from recognizing that you have this weird duality in your brain that, like, you didn't decide that. You didn't choose to have that idea about how men's or women's sexuality works. It was taught to you from the day people decided you were a boy or a girl. They started teaching you myths about how women's sexuality works and how men's sexuality works. And I use this garden metaphor in Come As You Are, that on the day you're born, you're given this plot of rich and fertile soil, and the adults and your culture start to plant things, and they tend the garden, and they teach you, they plant all these ideas about gender and bodies and sexuality and love and pleasure. So that by the time you get to adolescence, they're teaching you how to tend the garden yourself, and gradually you take it over. And now here you have this garden. And some of us get lucky with beautiful things that we want to cultivate, and all we have to do is weed and harvest. But some of us get some really toxic crap planted in our gardens. And we have this task of going through the garden row by row, choosing what we want to keep and nurture and what we want to throw out onto the compost heap to rot and use to feed better ideas that we choose for ourselves.
Right. Well, and it's an interesting process to figure out how to do that in our culture. You know, I think as both men and women, and I think there are issues that are different for both of them, but I think as women, you know, one of the things that we're told so often from our partners, from media, is that, you know, oh, I, the man, need, you know, like you say, need sex, want sex more than you do. And I think many women are sort of internally screaming, no, I just want it to look a little different. I don't want less, you know.
I just want better.
Right.
Yeah. There's a wonderful sex therapist and researcher named Peggy Kleinplatz, whose work I just adore. She's a sex therapist, so she sees a lot of couples with low sexual desire. And by the way, couples who seek therapy for desire are evenly split among heterosexual couples, whether it is the man or the woman in the partnership who has the lower desire. So despite the stereotype that it's men who want sex and women who don't, among couples who seek therapy, it's evenly split. But she asks her clients to describe the kind of sex they have when they do have that sex, and it's usually not very good. Like, neither of them experiences particularly much pleasure. And she will literally say to her clients, if I were having the sex you're having, I wouldn't want it either. No wonder you have low desire.
Wow, that's got to be an interesting thing to hear sitting there.
You know, it's a place for people to start. Right. We get into this place, I don't know how we got here as a culture, where we've decided that your level of dissatisfaction with the amount of sex you're having, that is to say your sexual desire, your hunger, your craving for sex, is somehow a measure of your sexual well-being. But here we are talking about desire. We have somehow put that at the center of our definition of sexuality. But one of the things that the research tells us is that we can change that if we instead put pleasure at the center of our definition of sexual well-being. All the other puzzle pieces will simply fall into place. Do you like the sex you are having? There's another sex therapist named Christine Hyde who taught me this wonderful metaphor she uses with her clients. She says, imagine your best friend invites you to a party. You say yes, because it's a party and you're best friend. But then as the date approaches, you start going, oh, I don't know, I gotta find childcare. Oh, there's going to be heavy traffic that night. Do I really want to put my clothes back on after a long week at work? I don't know. I could just be in my pajamas. But you know what? You said you would go, so you put on your party clothes and you go to the party. And what happens? Usually you have a good time at the party. Mm-hmm. And if you are having fun at the party, you are doing it right, regardless of how you felt an hour before the party started. Mm-hmm. And if the party is not fun, if it's, you know, not people you really enjoy hanging out with or trust or respect, if they're not like playing the kind of music you enjoy, there is no amount of longing to go to a party that's going to make that a party worth going to. So if couples focus not on desire, but on what kind of sex is worth having, that's Peggy's question to her clients, what kind of sex is worth having, then you will begin to want sex and anticipate it with pleasure because you know you're going to have a good time at the party.
Mm-hmm. And we don't, like, that's something that's not talked about. I mean, really not well talked about. It's certainly not talked in sex education.
Why? I mean, I know.
And it's so funny because it's so culturally, like, we almost, I think, if somebody talks about the pleasure they had too much, we don't want to hear it. You know, a little bit. But if we could just bring it into the picture, talk about it when we're young. Does this feel good? How do we get to know our partner? When you have a partner who really focuses on that, you know, does this feel good and wants to make you feel good or wants to mutually feel good, that's a very different experience. But I think a lot of people haven't had that experience.
So one of the ideas that my sister and I wrote about in the second book, Burnout, which is about stress, and I can talk about the origin story of that if you want to, but one of the most important ideas for us in that book is a phenomenon we call human giver syndrome, which we took from this very wonderful but very dark book called Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny by a moral philosopher named Kate Mann. In it, she describes a sort of imaginary world where there's two kinds of humans. There are human beings who have a moral obligation to be their full humanity and to do whatever it takes to be acquisitive, competitive, and entitled to take whatever they need to be their full humanity. And then there are the human givers who have a moral obligation to give their full humanity to the beings in support of their full personhood. So they give their time, attention, affection, their hopes and dreams, their bodies, their very lives sometimes sacrificed on the altar of someone else's comfort, convenience, and well-being. Guess which one women are culturally. Of course, it is not as simple as just like women are the givers and men are the human beings, because like I'm married to a cisgender dude who is a giver. And the dynamic in our relationship is very much both of us watching each other's boundaries and making sure neither of us just gives and gives and gives and gives and gives until we have nothing left. Mm. We help take care of each other and make sure each person is getting what they need and is taking the time away from caring for the other person.
And there's a whole nother book for you to write.
Right. Yeah. So the thing is, if women are the givers and men are the beings, if you bring that dynamic into a sexual relationship, oh, then we get like the story in Peggy Kleinplatz's book, Girls and Sex. She tells the story of a teenage girl alone with a teenage boy who wanted to have sex and she didn't want to have sex. And she was trying to find a way to get him out of her house. And the way she found to get him out of her house was to give him a blowjob. Mm-hmm. That was her way of de-escalating the situation, keeping herself safe by giving him a thing he wanted so that he would leave her house. Mm-hmm. Because the gender dynamic of beings and givers is such that a giver is not allowed to impose anything as burdensome as her own desires, her own needs on a human being. She's not allowed to say, here's what I want. You should give me that. Wow. When we talk about why people don't talk about pleasure, it's because we are so trapped in a narrative of sex as a commodity that is given and taken, given by one person and taken by another. Mm-hmm. When that is not what it is, it's the co-creation of an experience.
Right. Right. We've gotten into some really, like you say, how have we gotten to where we are at?
I mean, it's capitalism.
Well, right. And well, and I know I read an article in Playboy, this is quite a while back, but the author in Playboy was telling women, you have to, you know, don't be so easy. Make the men work for it a little bit more. You're giving too quickly. And, you know, and I thought that was an interesting perspective to come out in Playboy.
Yeah.
So
that's the nature of desire, though, right? Like, you can only want a thing you don't have. Once you have it, the desire is satisfied and you're done. Mm-hmm. How do you sustain desire for something that you just have all the time? That's why desire is such a trap. Pleasure, on the other hand, mm-hmm. is something that can be renewed and revived over and over. If we only ever do things we like, it's pretty hard to go wrong.
It puts a whole different spin on our cultural messages.
Yeah, because, you know, this is a nation founded by Puritans who thought the British were too sexually permissive.
Right.
So our relationship with pleasure, not just sexual pleasure, but all kinds of pleasure, is really fraught.
Right.
We have moral judgments about people who express pleasure and allow themselves to experience pleasure.
Right.
And that moral judgment is shaped by a person's gender. Women's relationship with pleasure is different from men's relationship with pleasure. We judge women differently. And it's also different based on race. We live in a culture where people of color, and especially Black people, are denied access to pleasure. And if they dare to express joy and pleasure and satisfaction, we perceive that we, white people like me, have this stereotype in our head of laziness, which mm-hmm. of course is born directly out of slavery and the ways that Black people's bodies were literal property. And so for them to experience joy inside their bodies and rest is a kind of theft from the white person who owns their bodies. These really sort of grotesque narratives underlying these really involuntary flashes of affect, emotion that we have when we hear about other people's joy.
Wow, that's interesting. That it has to be earned.
Sorry, I got
so
that dark
greatly.
There, but
no, well, it's an interesting point that I think you're right that we see, but we don't think about seeing it.
Yeah, it's all so, because people don't talk about it. This is all really subliminal. People are not, it's not like people are walking around with an explicit narrative in their head about, like, you know, when I see a person of color enjoying themselves, I really judge and shame them because I come from a culture of white supremacy. That is not how this works day to day. Men aren't walking around being like, no, I actually do believe that women's bodies belong in the public domain for men to compete for. Mm-hmm. And yet they behave as though they believe it without ever explicitly recognizing that that's the logic underneath it.
Well, and I want to, let's touch on this. So while we're talking about the pleasure piece and getting there and being sort of okay to experience pleasure and yeah. joy around sex and more than just in the moment of orgasm, because I think that's something that also happens, that there's a lot of joy outside that can be had outside of the moment of orgasm, but that's the part we see in the movies. That's, you know, but on the other side of that, one of the things that you talk about in your book is pain during sex.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit, because I think, again, that's something that women, again, I think don't know how to talk about, don't know if it's okay to talk about, put yeah. up with, or maybe embarrassed to deal with, not to mention aging.
Mm-hmm. So in the book, I say over and over again, yes, you're normal. Yes, that's a normal experience. All the diverse ranges of the things that you can be experiencing, yes, that's all normal, with one exception, and that is unwanted pain. Unwanted pain, talk to a medical provider. And I feel conflicted giving that advice, because it takes almost always more than one try to find a medical provider who's going to hear about your sexual pain and not dismiss it the same way you've been dismissing it in your own body for maybe decades. or say, you just need to relax, or, I mean, pain with sex is normal. Pain with sex is not normal. It is not supposed to hurt if you don't want it to. If you are choosing pain, do you? But if pain is happening and it makes sex unpleasant, and like if you went to a party and people like inflicted pain on you at that party, would you, yeah?
You're gonna leave.
Right.
Or try to leave.
You're not gonna wanna go to that party anymore.
Right.
Unless you find out like, oh, I like that. That's a whole different thing. Unwanted pain is the only not normal thing. So the Herman Wallace Foundation, when I ask people about like pelvic health and pain with sex, they refer me to the Herman Wallace Foundation over and over. So if people are experiencing pain with sex, start there and look for a provider near you who will actually listen to the pain that you're experiencing. There are evidence-based treatments available for a very wide variety of causes of sexual pain. And I know that one of the reasons why it's so difficult to find a provider who will listen is this human giver syndrome phenomenon where women are just expected to tolerate discomfort in the name of their partner's pleasure and satisfaction. Mm-hmm. That is that women are expected to tolerate the pain. I tie it in my mind to the origin story of Adam and Eve and pain with childbirth as our punishment. Mm. But pain with sex is somehow also our natural punishment for original sin.
That makes sense. But I mean, it also, doesn't make sense, but it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's completely bananas. And yet, this is the world we live in. I was just interviewed by North Carolina Public Radio, live, on the air. And the interviewer said, so when you're talking about pleasure, you say that orgasm is not the center of everything, like as though pleasure and orgasm are exactly the same thing, and they are not. Orgasm is one of the ways people can experience pleasure, but there is absolutely such a thing as an unwanted orgasm. Pleasure and desire are distinct networks in the brain. They're governed entirely separately. Pleasure is made up of these discrete little hotspots governed by the opioid system that light up when you experience something that feels good. Desire is the dopaminergic network that extends from the emotional brain into the cortex and reason and all the sort of like human level functioning. They're separate in the brain. And we as a culture have somehow conflated the two as if they are the same thing, wanting and liking, that if you want something, it must be pleasurable to you, which anybody who's had their heart broken knows that wanting something can be incredibly painful. Anybody who has, you know, eaten more than 2/3 of a pint of Haagen-Dazs in one sitting knows that, like, not everything that you like stays wanted for that long. Like, it's still delicious, but you're like, I don't want anymore. Pleasure and desire are separate things. And the more we can get clear about that, the more it really fixes a whole lot of misconceptions. Orgasm is one of the ways that we can experience pleasure, but just because it's an orgasm doesn't mean it's pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And this is the part where I want to start talking about arousal non-concordance. Can I do that?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome.
I was going to say, this seems like a perfect segue right there.
Yeah. Okay. So arousal non-concordance is this big, long term for when there is a mismatch between what your body or blood flow is doing and how turned on you feel subjectively. So it shows up in every emotional and motivational system that we have. One of my favorite non-sexual examples is when they try to look at the chills you experience listening to music. So the physiological marker of the chills is called piloerection, where your hair stands on end. Mm-hmm. Piloerection. So they'll play a research participant some music that is expected to cause chills, like My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion, for example. And the person will report whether they feel chills or not. And there's literally a camera looking at the person's arm, watching to see whether or not their hair stands on end. And it turns out there is not a significant relationship between whether your hair stands on end and whether you experience the chills. Another song they use is Purple Rain by Prince, right? So whether or not, and if you're Celine Dion or Prince, and people are coming to your concert, which do you want? Do you want people walking out going, you know, I didn't feel chills. My hair did stand on end, but I didn't really feel the chills. Or do you want them saying, oh, I had chills listening to that. And it doesn't matter what their hair is doing. Which thing matters more to you?
Right.
Obviously. You want people to have an experience that they really enjoy.
Right.
And the same thing is true with arousal non-concordance. When the blood flow to your genitals doesn't align with your subjective experience, it goes in both directions. Sometimes the blood flow is there when you do not feel aroused. And sometimes the blood flow is not there when you do feel aroused. We are not really sure why this is true. It is more typical of women's sexuality than men's sexuality. Probably the reason we don't all already know about it and accept it as normal and true is because it's more typical of women's sexuality than men's sexuality. Mm. When they bring men into a laboratory, you know, they sit them in this very comfortable lazy boy chair and they give them an instrument that measures changes to their blood flow. And then they show them a whole bunch of porn and the instrument measures changes in blood flow to the genitals. But while that's happening on a dial, it's literally called an arousometer. He rates how aroused he feels. Mm-hmm. And there's a significant correlation between those two things. When they do the same thing for women, an instrument to measure blood flow, an arousometer, and a whole lot of different kinds of porn, there is not a significant relationship between the blood flow and how aroused a person feels. Specifically with heterosexual women, with lesbian women, this actually doesn't happen. Their bodies have a higher level of concordance. And again, we have no idea why. But culturally, because, you know, patriarchy, we sort of look at how men work and assume that that's how women are supposed to work. And the ways that women work that are different from the ways men work are how the ways that they're broken and wrong and need to be fixed. Instead of just being like, oh, men and women are not identical. Go figure.
Right.
That's like a radical statement.
Right. Well, and if we would focus a little more on women and their sexuality and how they work, we could, you know, figure that out, come together, and men could have much more fun, sexy time. And so could women.
Anytime I write about these things that are more typical of like responsive desire, desire that emerges in response to pleasure rather than in anticipation of pleasure, arousal non-concordance, I always get emails from men saying, thank you, this describes what I have experienced. Anybody with a penis who has struggled to get an erection one night and then woken up with an erection the next morning when it's nothing but a hassle, mm-hmm. knows that arousal non-concordance is a thing. Sometimes the blood flow is there, sometimes it's not. And just because you have blood flow, any teenage boy who's gotten an erection because, you know, of the vibrations at the back of a school bus or because the wind blew the wrong direction, poor 13-year-old boys. Right. Oh my God. You know that arousal, just because your blood flow is happening doesn't mean that you want or like what's going on. The reason it happens, I think, is because your brain is noticing a sex-related stimulus that's happening, which is not necessarily something that is pleasurable or desired. We live in a sufficiently screwed up world that something sexually relevant may be happening in a context where it is not enjoyed and it is not desired. But your body will respond anyway because its job is to respond to things that are sex-related, regardless of whether it's wanted or liked.
And that can come in the form of a movie or an experience right. with
or
a person.
Story or like a person touching you. You don't like the touching. You don't want the touching. And yet your body is responding to the touching as being sex-related. And it is sex-related touch. That is appropriate for your body to respond. It does not mean that you want or like what is going on. And we live in this narrative of you said no, but your body said yes. Mm-hmm. Bodies don't say yes or no. Bodies just say, that's a sex-related stimulus. That's not a sex-related stimulus, which is not the same as yes or no.
Right.
Because you can, something can be sex-related and you want it and you like it. And you still say no for any number of reasons, because you're in a place that feels too public for you, because you don't have access to contraception and you would like to prevent any kind of pregnancy, because you don't know the person's sexual history and you don't want to risk STIs. Any number of reasons why you might want like a sexually relevant stimulus and still say no, and that you might not want or like something that you do say yes to, like the teenage girl giving the guy a blowjob. She didn't want the sex-related stimulus. She wanted to get him out of her house.
Right.
A lot of different kinds of motivations for having sex. And like, that's a survival strategy. She avoided any sort of violence or further coercion by de-escalating.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't mean that she wanted and liked it.
Right, exactly. It's a yes. And that comes up, that whole, Amy Schumer has a name for it that I can't remember what it is. The whole when you want to get him out of your house kind of sex. I can't remember what it is. But I've had conversations where guys will say, you know, women don't really do that. And women are sitting there shaking their heads. Yes. Going, yeah. Oh yeah. You know, exactly. This is just, it's a safety issue sometimes. Or I was listening to a story about somebody who, he said she was verbally saying yes, but her body language was saying no. And he thought that, you know, she was probably just saying yes to be nice. And so he basically said, I just cut it off. Basically, he's like, I was going to read whatever no signal was happening, whether it was coming from her body or her mouth, and let it go. You know, he says, I think it was a pressure thing that she was feeling. I have to say yes in this moment. Again, culture.
Right.
I want to talk about just how that has been used against women on a sexual assault level. But the one thing I do want to bring up too, and you mentioned it in the book, is tickling is one of those things.
Yeah.
Where you, and I remember this as a kid, and this was a trust breaking thing. Like I remember, I have very vivid memories of how this started to have me not trust how the world worked, because I would push people away. I hated being tickled. And in many cases. And of course the answer was, but you're laughing.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't know how to help laughing. Like, what do I have to do to say no to you right now?
Right. Just because you're laughing doesn't mean that you enjoy the tickling. That's just the reflexive behavior that happens in response to that sensation. It does not mean that you want it or like it. If a person's laughing and screaming no, why not try listening to the no?
Right.
Taking space back. And if the person actually does want to be tickled, what are they going to do? They're going to come after you and be like, tickle me.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And you see kids do that too. You know, I mean, I see little kids do that. They put themselves in the space because it's fun and it's in a good space and they're happy and trusting the situation.
Yeah.
I always go.
And if they want to keep playing and you stop and you're like, oh, you don't want me to tickle you? Okay, I'm not going to tickle you. They will come and play with you. They want to be tickled.
Right.
That's how you know. So if you're in that kind of situation as an adult in a sexual situation, so there's a lot of nerdy brain science about why the situation with tackling happens, where sometimes it's pleasurable and sometimes it's not pleasurable. The same thing is true with spanking. If you're in a hot and heavy, sexy situation, you like really trust and care about your partner and you're having a great turned on time and your partner swats your butt, that could feel really sexy and good. You've put your brain in a context where it's ready to interpret pretty much any sensation as sex related. Whereas if you're in, this is a literal story I was told, if you are changing your baby's diaper and up to your wrists in poop and your partner swats your ass and says, hey, do you want to have sex tonight? That does not feel great. You are unlikely to say yes.
Oh dear, that's
funny. A woman at a conference told me this story over lunch when I was talking about this whole pleasure desire thing. And she was like, can you please tell this to my husband? Because this is how he tries to initiate sex. And if he initiates this way, I feel bad, but the answer is always no.
Right.
And I think about all the other things that he could have done. Like just about any other thing would have been better than that thing.
Any other thing, any other time, anything.
Right.
Oh, yes, context matters.
Context is absolutely essential. One of the difficulties with pleasure as the central aspect of sexuality is that pleasure does actually change depending on the context. So one of the questions I get asked by men about women is, you know, I touched her this way and she really loved it this one time. I touched her the exact same way the next day and she wasn't interested at all. What's the matter with her is usually the question. And the question is, nothing's the matter. The context changed. Like if you think about over the course of a 10-year relationship, in the first year, the hot and heavy falling in love, you're like cooking the dinner for the romance and your partner comes over and starts kissing you and saying the certain special something or others, you go ahead and let the dinner burn because who cares?
Right.
Because it's so pleasurable and fun. But 10 years later, 10 years and, you know, maybe a kid or two and 10 years of accumulated frustrations about who's going to take out the trash and do the dishes. And just because you've put the dishes out of the sink and into the dishwasher doesn't mean you've cleaned the kitchen, dear. So you're making the dinner to feed your family and your partner comes over and starts kissing on you and saying the certain special somethings. And you're just like, will you go set the table, please?
Right.
Nothing is wrong. It's just the context in which your brain is interpreting those sensations is totally different. So when I say put pleasure at the center of your definition of sexual well-being, I don't just mean like being touched in particular places or in particular ways. I mean creating a context that allows your brain to interpret the world as a safe, fun, sexy, pleasurable place. Precisely what that context will be is going to vary a lot from person to person. For most people, it's a context that's low stress, high trust, high affection, and not least, explicitly erotic. Mm-hmm. For most people vary, but for a lot of people, it's going to be a context like that. And you can figure out sort of what context is going to work best for you. There's like a whole chapter full of worksheets on this in the Come As You Are workbook. But if you just think about like, what are some great sexual experiences I've had? And what are the commonalities in the context that let those experiences be so extraordinarily good? In Peggy Kleinplatz's research on optimal sexual experiences, she interviews people who self-identify as having great sex lives. And she asks them, how did you get to a place where you were having great sex? And how old were you when it started happening? And their answer to the first question, how did you start having great sex, was I had to unlearn everything I thought I knew about how sex works. I had to unlearn all these gender roles. I had to unlearn all the ideas I had about performance and like the sexual script of what order everything's supposed to go in and what it's supposed to look like and feel like. I had to forget all that and just learn to be present in the moment with this person. And the average age at which her interviewees first experienced it was 55.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is, it's good that there's hope.
Absolutely.
But man, why not get that? Why not bring that farther?
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you're under the age of 55, you are already way ahead of the curve.
Wow, that's crazy.
Because that's the average age. It means about half of people were older than that.
That is just
amazing. It doesn't ever end. The opportunity to grow and expand your access to sexual pleasure doesn't end.
You mentioned the workbook, and I haven't taken a look at the workbook yet. Is that a good place to start? I'm thinking, you know, if you're either in a relationship and you're kind of trying to bring things to a new place, or you are not in a relationship, but you're thinking about future relationships, et cetera, is that a great way to kind of help you back out and re-enter?
Absolutely. The workbook is good for, it's a practical, pragmatic, I don't want to read about the neuroscience. I don't want to like have all the new ideas put into like a bigger scientific and historical context. No, I don't care about like the medieval sex book that should reinforce the myth, blah, blah, blah. I just want a worksheet so that I can figure out what works for me. The workbook is very accessible. If you need to be persuaded that arousal non-concordance is a thing, there's a whole chapter about that science in Come As You Are. If you need to be persuaded, if you want to understand what's going on in your brain when it comes to context and how it changes your perception of pleasure, there's a whole chapter about that and the dual control model, the two components of your brain that govern sexual response. So if you want the science, if you want the history, then Come As You Are offers like all that much deeper stuff. And what I hear from people a lot is that they really needed all of that science and all of that history to help them understand how deeply they had absorbed these messages without even knowing that those were messages that they had absorbed, without realizing that they were myths. So if you want like the big, deep stuff, come as you are. But if you want practical, hands-on, I just need to think about me and how I work and how these ideas fit into my own personal sexual relationship, the workbook is worksheet after worksheet of what is true about me.
I do think even if somebody is not a super science person, I think you make it really, really accessible. And I do think the context is so important. It creates so much validity when you're listening. It's like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, yep, uh-huh, I resonate with that, and that's why, and I'm not alone.
Yes.
I think is so, I really just think it's so huge to have that, especially, you know, for women to sort of have the, I'm not alone and oh my gosh, I am normal. And for men to kind of go, okay. My partner isn't the only one saying that.
Right. Yeah. She's not crazy or broken.
Right.
That's just the thing we all got taught. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a difficult thing when you're doing myth busting, and come as you are is just sort of myth bust after myth bust after myth bust, from genitals to cultural context and scripts. It's really important in order to like create an environment of compassion so the person doesn't feel like they were wrong or like it's dumb to believe these things. Like, of course you believe these things. Everything about the English-speaking world has reinforced these ideas for you for generations, for centuries. People have believed this stuff, and it's only in the last 30 or 40 years that the science has shown us how wrong we were. And it's going to take time to dig out those old beliefs and replace them with what the science is finally showing us is true. Mm-hmm. So right. I want the reason that context I think is so helpful for people is because they know that what they're experiencing sexually is normal. And the fact that they didn't know they were normal before is also normal. Mm. Of course you didn't know. You were lied to your whole life. Sorry about that. Trying to help.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I have this feeling of like, there's this really big job. I'm like climbing a mountain here. And like people are helping and it's like we're making good progress. So one of the things I do for pleasure is read and write romance novels.
Oh, fun.
And there's a wonderful feminist, sex positive romance writer named Courtney Milan, who wrote a book called The Suffragette Scandal, in which her heroine is a suffragette. And the hero is a sort of like jaded, he used to have all these ideals, but he's like, no, none of it matters. And he's like, you are trying to scoop water out of the Thames to change the river with thimbles and teaspoons, and you're not going to make any difference. And the heroine says, you know, you're looking at the river and I'm looking at the garden. I'm taking those thimbles and those spoonfuls and I'm putting it in the garden. And as long as that is growing, then I know that I'm doing what I need to be doing. And I will stay here. And all of the women who are working with me are going to stay here with our thimbles and our teaspoons. And we're going to keep watering the garden. And eventually it's going to take over the shore.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because it does. The work that you're doing, I can imagine, just because of the work that I know I'm doing,
right?
It feels like small and you know, you feel like, gosh, am I making any headway? But it's also like, but I can't stop because otherwise and you know, whether it's patriarchy, big business, et cetera,
right.
They win. Yeah. And what does that look like if we all just lay down and go, oh, okay, whatever, it's fine. It's not fun for any of us, really.
So it's different from fun. And there is, so this is another thing that shows up in burnout, because burnout is very much written from the point of view of my sister and my's different experiences of working really hard and collapsing in a heap. My sister, to the extent that she was literally hospitalized twice.
Wow.
Because she was working so hard to like do the thing and fight the patriarchy and make art. And I was never hospitalized, but I've certainly collapsed in a heap and sobbed uncontrollably and, you know, done the things that you do when you care a lot about a project that is way bigger than you personally can master. And one of the things we learned in researching the book is that our experiences of shared effort, specifically moving our bodies in time with other people for a shared purpose, is one of our most profound, most nourishing sources of joy. So when we put our bodies in a space of worship, regardless of what that is, with other people. When we dance, when we sing, when we march, we are putting our bodies in a space with other people's bodies and moving in time with a shared purpose. And we cross what researchers call a neurological bridge out of a sense of just, it's just me, and into a sense of I am part of something larger than just my individual self. I am within this larger body. And when we can just, even if it's just once a month or once a week, if we have a moment of that experience, it is so nourishing and revitalizing and keeps us stable and sane and committed when we know that we're not actually alone. And it doesn't matter that we're really small relative to the change we want to make in the world, because we're not what's making the change. What's making the change is us along with all these other people who are moving with us in a shared purpose. And right. By the way, sex is one of those things that we can do. Mm-hmm. Want to move your body in time with another person? Right. Sex is a great, like, you can create a powerful sense of this is us. This is our connection and our relationship. The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over multiple decades are not the couples who constantly can't wait to have sex with each other. They are not even the couples who have like wild adventurous sex. One of my favorite recent studies found that the best predictor of sex and relationship satisfaction wasn't frequency of sex or orgasm or anything like that, how long the sex lasted. No. It was whether the couple cuddled after sex. The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection instead, they have two things in common when you get down to it. One, they're good friends. They trust each other. And two, they prioritize sex. They decide that it matters for their relationship, that they stop doing, God, all the other things they could be doing, the dishes and child rearing and jobs and other family members and friends. And God forbid, they just want to like watch some TV and go to sleep. Stop doing, close the door on all that other stuff and just focus on putting your body in the bed with this other person, letting your skin touch theirs, and allowing your body to go, all right, I like this person. I like this. And you share that experience of pleasure together because of the impact it has on your relationship overall. You carry that moment of pleasure with you for all the time that you can't get to each other because of all the other stuff you have to do.
And weaving. And you don't really talk about this, but you kind of do, weaving that thread through that relationship. So, you know, through those non-sexual times to keep things connected as well in whatever way possible.
Yeah. John Gottman, the relationship researcher, has this recommendation of a daily 6-second kiss. 6 seconds is a potentially awkward long time to kiss somebody. You gotta really like them, right?
Right.
But that's the point, is that it shows your body each and every day, I have this person in my life whom I like and trust enough to put my mouth on their mouth for 6 whole seconds in a row. It shifts something in your chemistry to know that you have to physically experience being connected to another person with that level of intimacy. Another recommendation is the 20-second hug. Doesn't have to be exactly 20 seconds, but again, like, it could be awkward. You got to really like somebody to hug them for that long.
Right.
Susanna Iacenza calls it hugging until relaxed, where you just hold your body against the other person's body until you feel a shift in your chemistry, where your body goes, oh, right, I'm home. When I'm with this person, I have come to a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Right. And those are such nourishing experiences.
And it takes astonishingly little, 30 seconds in a day. Can we find that for each other?
Like you say, it's simple, but it's that.
But everything interferes. Everything is
right
between you and that person. The last TED Talk I did, I talk about the hedgehog metaphor. And this all comes from me talking to a couple of friends. We were in a bar having drinks. And they sort of very casually are like, so Emily, how do couples sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term? They had 2 small kids. They were very sleep deprived. And had experienced the thing that lots of couples experience when they've got young kids, which is that they really struggle to connect with each other sexually. And I started talking about, well, you put your body in the bed, you let skin touch your partner's skin, and you let your body wake up and go, oh, right, I like that. And one of the partners looked at me with a cringe on her face, like I had just suggested that she roll around with cockroaches. Oh. And I was like, okay, so there's your problem. It is not that you don't want the sex, it's that you don't like the sex. You dread the sex.
Mm-hmm.
That is a bigger situation. It's not actually a sexual problem at all. That's a relationship issue where, so there's another sex therapist I saw do an activity where she has a couple stand up physically, take their bodies out of their chairs and create as much physical space between them as they need in order to feel safe and like there's no pressure to do anything they don't want to do. And the less interested partner creates 20 feet of space. Like, that's how distant they need to be in order not to feel like they're going to be pulled into something that they don't feel okay about.
Mm-hmm.
And that space is not empty. The reason it's that big is because it's crowded with the months or years or decades of, you're not listening to me, but I don't know what's wrong with me. But when you criticize me, that doesn't help. And if you love me, you would do the thing. And like all the years of miscommunication and hurt. So it's no longer about the sex. Mm-hmm. It's all the hurt feelings you're both carrying around about the sex that you have to process together. Oh, we got to talk about her feelings.
Right. No. But you got to find the way through, and that's the only way through, right?
Yeah. When you like the person, when you respect them, you value what they bring to your life on some level, you have a reason. It has to be worth it.
Right.
So I went through a version of this in my own relationship. Writing a book about sex is very stressful. And I was so stressed out while I was writing it that I had, even though I was thinking about sex all the time, I had no interest in having any actual sex. And then I went on the road. I travel a lot and I was out of the house, and man, I would get home from all this travel and I would, you know, put my body in the bed, let my skin touch my partner's skin. And I was so exhausted, I would just cry and fall asleep, which is... it's what happens sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure my husband on those moments was like, well, I guess I'm not having sex today. he was so kind and patient and understanding and gave me so much space to let my body heal and recover from all that work. He was there for me. He was kind and generous and open-hearted and willing to talk to me about his feelings and willing to listen to mine, so that as we went through the process of trying to undo all the difficult feelings that we had created, it pulled us closer together, that process.
Right.
It's not about fighting. It's about looking at this mess between the two of us. It's like if you've got a really cluttered closet made of your stuff and your partner's stuff, like you just have to stand there together and sort out what you're going to keep and what you're going to discard. And in the process of doing that, remember why you trust and love this person.
Right. Right. Which is a lot. I mean, it's a lot to do, but
it is.
My gosh. You know, and you come out the other side. I'm guessing you came out the other side stronger.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. As I talk about it, I'm like, God, I'm so lucky. Holy crap. He's so smart, and he's so nice, and he's funny, and he's cute. Oh my gosh, I'm so lucky.
Right? That's awesome.
He was willing to do this work because he felt like it was worth it for us.
Oh, that's awesome. That's right? Great. Those are great stories. It's so beautiful.
I have to say, the couple where she cringed away, they got divorced.
Oh.
Because again, for them, it was not a sexual problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was her deep sense that he was not there for her in some really crucial ways.
Right.
And sometimes the damage goes so deep that it can't be repaired.
Right.
That's another way that it happens. My personal point of view is that because they managed to sustain a relationship that lets them co-parent in a really effective way and show respect for each other so that their kids can witness that, that's not a failure of their relationship. That's just a transition.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. We also have this thing in this culture that you need to hate your ex.
Yeah.
That just, I've seen examples of it where people have come through and they have literally friends and family saying, that's not how it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to get along. And it's like, why? It's working. Why make it harder on us and the kids and, you know, let it be what it is. Well, it's just not how you're supposed to do that. You're supposed to you're not supposed to see your ex, or you're not supposed to like them. And it's like, I've heard that so many times and it kind of blows my mind.
I'm not sure. How does it contribute something positive to the world to hate somebody you once loved?
Exactly. And a person that I knew who had that exact thing. This is the mother of my children. This is somebody I get married to.
Yeah.
You know?
And especially when there's co-parenting involved, like you have to spend time together. It's like having a coworker you disagree with a lot. Like you have a thing you need to do together. So you better find a way to make it work.
Right. And it's so much better for the kids, and they get to see a great example of how you can have a bad experience with each other and come through and still care about each other and be looking out for each other's best interests.
Yes.
You know, and we need more of that in the world.
Each other's best interest is we need to not live in the same house.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I know we're running short on time. Do you have a couple minutes to talk about the sexual non-concordance as it kind of works with sexual assault? Just because I think that is such an important piece and I don't want to miss that.
Yes. So again, this is a very, very old myth. You said no, but your body said yes. I have lost track of the number of times it has happened that I've given a talk about arousal non-concordance and someone will send me an email or even hand me a note at the end of a lecture to say, you're describing what happened to me and I never understood before. Literally one note that told me about an unwanted sexual experience. It was a woman assaulted by a man and she kept saying no. And he kept saying, no, you're so wet. You're so wet. You're so ready. Don't be shy. Shy as if like it hadn't taken all the courage that she had to say no to someone whom she liked and wanted to do some things with, but didn't had reached the point where she was no longer interested. And yet she was trying to say no. And he's like, no, you're so wet. You're ready. You want it. I know you do. You're just being shy. And because he said it, and that was the cultural myth that all of us have absorbed, she believed him instead of believing what her own internal experience was telling her. And because of that, it wasn't until she learned about arousal non-concordance that she felt like she could call what happened to her rape. Because her body responded, she thought that meant that on some level she must have wanted or liked it. And that's not true. So the reason I want everyone to know about arousal non-concordance is because it might happen to them. They might have a partner whose body is responding even while they are saying no. And when there's that difference, what do you pay attention to? What a person's blood flow is doing or the words coming out of their mouths? Listen to the person's words. They might be on a jury for a sexual assault case. And oh yeah, the defense attorney is going to ask about genital response because survivors of sexual assault will experience genital response potentially up to and including orgasm. And there are defense attorneys who really want a jury to believe that orgasm is the same as consent. When in fact, survivors who have orgasms during their assault feel betrayed by their bodies because they've been taught their whole lives that orgasm is a peak of pleasure and somehow pleasure is the same thing as saying yes. They know that they did not want or like what was happening, and yet their body did this thing, and it requires therapy usually to begin rebuilding a trusting, loving relationship with their own bodies after this moment of intense betrayal. And if you're on a jury and a defense attorney tries to do that to you, now you will know. You'll be able to explain to everyone else in the jury, hey, arousal non-concordance, just because a person's genitals respond to something as sex-related doesn't mean it is either wanted or liked. Duh.
Right. Right.
So yeah, because all of us grew up with this idea that, I mean, again, I read romance novels. And when I was a teenager reading romance novels, what they taught me was that wetness means you are ready, that you can tell by what a person's blood flow is doing whether or not they like what's happening. That is absolutely what I learned. And when I found the arousal non-concordance research, my brain exploded. Mm-hmm. I literally remember the day I learned about this research. That was in a conference room at Indiana University Student Union, and I have not seen my brain since. Like everything changed.
Like you said, it's the big cultural thing. And
it also impacted me as a person who'd done work around sexual assault prevention and crisis response, because there had been times when my own body had responded listening. You know, I was working on a crisis hotline. People who had been sexually assaulted would tell me details of their assault. And there were times when my body responded and I worried that doing this work was damaging my sexuality, that it was somehow turning me into someone who wanted and liked coerced sex. Mm-hmm. And when I learned about arousal non-concordance, I was like, oh!
I'm normal.
I'm normal. That's a sex-related stimulus for someone to describe sexually explicit behaviors. So sometimes my body does respond to that. That does not mean it is wanted or liked. It's just part of a thing that happens sometimes.
It's an interesting thing when I think of that with, I know you describe a thing in the book where somebody is watching somebody rape a girl who's sleeping or out in some way. Right. And I hear that too sometimes with men and porn where they're like, well, she said she didn't like what we were watching, but her body was responding in such a way that she did. So she must really like it. And now she's not being honest with me.
Right. Yeah. And that's part of the patriarchal myth is that women don't know what they want. They say they want the things they don't want, and they say they don't want the things they actually do want. You can't trust women. And that's, I got a big rush of emotion when I just said that out loud. Women struggle enough to trust and believe themselves. Most of us grew up learning to believe other people's opinions about our bodies more than we believe what our own internal experience is trying to say to us. Mm-hmm. We dismiss our own internal experience, and it's gaslighting, essentially, in a sexual context where people are saying, no, I know better what you want and like than you do. Mm-hmm. And no, turns out. So if we can all recognize that just because a person's blood flow is doing anything doesn't mean they want or like it, that your body can, and especially as a sex educator, sex therapists go through the same thing. You have to be exposed as part of your sexual attitude reassessment to a very wide variety of sexually explicit media. So many different kinds of porn, all the porn you don't want to think about. And process the ways that your body does or doesn't respond to it, the ways that you can feel like your genitals are experiencing tingly blood flow, but also you feel disgusted at the same time. Like, what's that about? What's going on there? So you become confronted very, very concretely with the ways that your body responds to things that do not turn you on. Right. I don't think everybody needs to go through a week-long intensive exposure. They just need to begin noticing when their bodies respond and when they don't, and what the relationship is between their body's response and the context and sexual stimulation they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if a woman is telling you she doesn't like something, or that she even does like something, or whatever, that it, like you say, it's hard enough to speak that. Sometimes just to have the courage to say, to express a desire or a dislike.
And like the story you were telling about the woman who was saying yes, but her partner was sort of feeling a no in her body or mm-hmm. in her voice, it can never hurt and can often do a lot of good to slow down and wait if there is any ambivalence. Ambivalence is a normal part of the sexual experience. And like with tickling, like if a kid is screaming, no, don't tickle me, and you stop playfully and they chase after you and want to be tickled more, you know what's going on there. But if you keep going, you can do very serious harm. So the right choice when there's ambivalence is always slow down. Notice all the conflicting things that are going on in your body. That is normal. That is, that's what sex is like. Multiple things at the same time. And allow the things that are interfering with pleasure to drop away, and only do things that you enjoy. Did you know people believe things more when they rhyme?
Oh gosh, I'm not surprised, but I hadn't heard that.
The thing I learned in the process of writing Come As You Are. So I made a rhyme. Are you ready?
Yes. Here it is.
Pleasure is the measure. Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being. It's not about how much you crave sex. It's not orgasms or performance or anything like that. It's whether or not you like the sex you are having.
If you
like it, then you are doing it right. If only pleasure were simple, but it also means creating a context that lets your brain interpret the world as a safe, fun, sexy place where you are free to experience pleasure. And the slower you go, the easier it is to find your way on that sometimes dark and brambly path.
Mm. Awesome. Well, thank you.
This is my favorite thing to talk about.
I really think that schools should use your book as a textbook.
I met a high school librarian who told me that he managed to sneak Come As You Are into the high school library by saying it was a science book. And it is. It's a science book.
I was going to say, just because it's delivered in a very I don't even want to say non-sciencey way, but just accessible way, a way that's easy for anybody to listen to and get.
Yeah.
But the science is clearly there.
Yeah.
Clearly there. So yes, I love it. You know, and I even think the subtitle of your book, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. You know, some of those, I look at those subtitles and I feel like they're boastful. This one I feel like is pretty dead on. It's like, oh yeah, of course, right.
We actually chose that title because it literally did transform my editor's sex life.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Oh, well, this is great. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
And I really appreciate it. And good luck to spreading the good word and keeping up the work that you're doing. You're doing great, great, great things. And we need more of you in the world. So yay.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Again, you can find Emily's information in the show notes. You can also look on her website at emilynagoski.com. You can also Google her information and TED Talks and some great stuff. You can find her on Amazon, and I would ask if you are going to purchase her books, please do go through our affiliate program, if you wouldn't mind, in a way to support the podcast. Again, no cost to you, but if you go to wellnessrenpodcast.com and support the podcast, we'll lead you to the Amazon links, and we will have the books up there. And if you click through that, a little tiny portion goes to support the podcast. Actually, a little tiny portion of any purchase you make when you go through that website. So for those of you who do that and take that extra couple clicks, we sure do appreciate it. I want to bring us back just for a second to one of the things that Emily said. She was talking about the couple that their marriage ended, but they continued working together as successful co-parenters. And she said that she would consider that relationship not a failure, but a transition. It's an interesting thing that we've set up in our culture. I know Dan Savage, probably many more as well, but that's who I mostly hear it from, talks about the fact that we consider any relationship that ends a failure. We've set it up as till death do us part, and the only way to have a successful relationship is one of you has to die. We could have probably had a whole nother hour conversation on that alone, for sure. But I wanted to bring that back up because I think that is a really interesting and powerful point. Just to give you a little bit of a sneak peek, we are going to be talking to some folks who are doing some great work with social justice right here in Minnesota, as well as someone who works with anybody, but especially folks in the queer and trans community, helping them overcome religious trauma to be able to embrace their true identity and their true calling. So look forward to that and a lot of other great stuff on the way too. Until next week, take good care and may you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle. Be well. Bye-bye.